This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 7th, 2009. From Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Rose Katopchi, sitting in for Aura Bogado. In today's newscast, despite a brief ceasefire, little humanitarian aid enters Gaza and the Israeli military continues its attacks. Dismal numbers for the 2009 budget deficit, and an innovative program in Washington State delivers organic produce to low-income families. Stay tuned for that and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Russia continues to reduce the flow of natural gas into Europe today, leaving people in several countries without heat. Yesterday, the Russian national energy company, Gazprom, reduced pipeline shipments because of a dispute with Ukraine. The cutoffs have left countries like Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, Romania, and Turkey without fuel and have forced them to dip into their rapidly shrinking national reserves. The crisis highlights Europe's dependence on Russian energy and has many calling for greater energy independence, which could come in the form of nuclear power. The investigation into the November Mumbai, India attacks took another turn today when Pakistan officially accepted that Ajmal Kassab, the only person currently in custody for involvement in the attack, is a Pakistani citizen. Both countries have their military forces on alert at the border, but the Pakistan intelligence chief says he does not foresee war. Afridi Afridi has more from Pakistan.
The big news in Pakistan today is Indian allegations that Pakistani government agencies had a hand in training those involved in the attacks. But Pakistan has continuously denied those accusations since the first day. Most Pakistani critics think India's media played an important role in placing blame on their country. Today, Pakistan officially acknowledged India's claim that the man in custody is a Pakistani national, a day after India provided a detailed report on their investigation. But ex-minister Hamid Nawaz says this was forced by foreign diplomatic pressure.
There is collective pressure from both India and the U.S. on Pakistan to accept the responsibility for the Mumbai attacks. Slowly and gradually, Pakistan will give in. The first step towards accepting all Indian allegations is accepting that the arrested man is a Pakistani citizen.
But despite the back and forth between the two countries, most Pakistani citizens are more worried about unrelated military operations with their own country rather than the threat of war with India. For FSRN, it is Afridi Afridi.
Seven activists and opposition party members being held by the Zimbabwe government were formally charged today for alleged involvement in a bombing plot. All seven pleaded not guilty. The international community and the group Zimbabwean Lawyers for Human Rights have criticized Zimbabwe for arresting countless activists, saying they have been tortured and not provided proper medical care. The government also did not comply with a Zimbabwe High Court ruling demanding the prisoners' release in late December. In other news, the death toll from the country's growing cholera epidemic has topped 1,750 people. President-elect Barack Obama is actively pursuing a famous neurosurgeon for the position of Surgeon General. Mark Dadigan has more.
For the past 7 years, Dr. Sanjay Gupta has worked as CNN's healthcare correspondent, where he demystifies complex medical issues for regular Americans.
Hollywood is fascinated by memory loss. Movies like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Memento, and 50 First Dates probably reflect our fears. 4.5 million Americans have Alzheimer's, but there is hope on the horizon.
Although the 39-year-old Gupta has not officially confirmed it, the Washington Post reports he is President-elect Barack Obama's choice for Surgeon General. It's a position that doesn't carry much power, but rather serves to promote and market the administration's healthcare message. Gupta, the son of Indian parents, is a polished TV personality whose media experience could prove highly useful in the position. However, some doubt his credentials. Members of the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service, which the Surgeon General oversees, have expressed concern about his lack of public health experience. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mark Dadigan.
Health insurance company Blue Shield will reinstate medical coverage to nearly 700 Californians whose policies were canceled after they got sick. FSRN's Christina Anastad has the details.
It's called rescission, granting a client health insurance, then taking it back after learning the client failed to disclose health complications. But in the case of Blue Shield, the insurance company canceled the policies of nearly 700 people after they became ill. After negotiations with the state, the company has agreed to reinstate those policies. Daryl Lang is a public relations officer for the Department of Insurance.
This agreement makes sure that every person who had their insurance taken away has all of their out-of-pocket expenses covered. It offers them new insurance as of today with no underwriting. So if you have a pre-existing condition, that's not an issue. And number three, it provides safeguards to make sure that this situation doesn't happen again.
According to the LA Times, whose reporting led to the state's crackdown on the company, policyholders must give up their right to sue in order to obtain medical reimbursement. Lawyers for some of the victims criticize this aspect of the deal, saying without health insurance, some of the policyholders were forced into bankruptcy. I'm Christina Onnestad for Free Speech Radio News.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy announced an agreement between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority, but released no details and didn't mention Hamas. But an Israeli official who commented on the proposal indicated that the military's attacks on Gaza won't come to an end until rocket fire into Israel stops and the international community supports an arms embargo on Hamas. Meanwhile, a three-hour-long ceasefire observed today by the Israeli military and Hamas did little to get desperately needed humanitarian aid into Gaza. After the ceasefire expired, both sides began their attacks again. Israeli warplanes also dropped leaflets today on the borderlines between Gaza and Egypt, ahead of demolishing dozens of homes. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports from Rafah City.
The leaflets told residents of southern Rafah City to leave their homes ahead of Israeli army actions. Fida Qishta is a Rafah resident.
The leaflets asked those on the borderlines to evacuate their homes. They also ordered others by phone to leave the homes. One of the residents responded to a phone order by wondering that he doesn't have a tunnel, so why to evacuate?
According to Ghazi Hamad, a former Hamas government spokesperson who lives in the area, at least 80 homes were then destroyed by Israeli air raids. Early this morning, Israeli airstrikes also destroyed dozens of smuggling tunnels connecting Gaza to Egypt. In the meantime, Israeli media sources reported today that Israel allowed in fuel for Gaza's power plant. Darar Abu Sisi, the operations director of the plant, confirms to FSRN that the quantities Israel let in will generate electricity for just one day. There have been unprecedented blackouts in Gaza since Israel began attacking on December 27th. Since then, Israeli military attacks on the Hamas-run territory have claimed the lives of 700 people, 33% of them women and children. More than 3,000 others are wounded, nearly half of them women and children, according to medical sources. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almagari in Gaza.
FSRN has just learned from our Gaza correspondent Rami Almagari that Israeli drones are flying above his home in the Maghazi refugee camp in Gaza City. The unmanned military planes dropped bombs on a local police station just 500 feet from his home. Despite a rising death and injury toll, U.S. government reaction to the conflict in Gaza has been slow, with few lawmakers making public statements about the crisis, including President-elect Barack Obama. But a former presidential contender, Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, took his time on the House floor today to raise questions about the U.S. relationship with Israel. Whether or not continued military aid to the country is a violation of the Arms Export Control Act.
I oppose Hamas's rocket attacks on Israel. The rocket attacks, even to try to end the blockade, have no moral justification, are illegal, and must stop. But how can Israel claim self-defense when it bombs Gaza, which has no army, no air force, no navy, and has been under a constant blockade? How can Israel claim self-defense when its bombs destroy UN schools, killing children? The children of Palestinians and the children of Israel both deserve life. But the lives of the children of Gaza are cynically discounted as human shields. Massacres are being rationalized. Israel's moral high ground in Gaza, a growing pile of small bones in a graveyard. The administration knows Israel is using U.S. weapons paid for by U.S. taxpayers with disproportionate force, creating a collective punishment of Gazans, assuring an escalation of conflict, clear violations of the Arms Export Control Act. Israel was given U.S. weapons on condition they could not be used for aggression or escalation. This outgoing administration must finally stand for the rule of law, not the rule of force.
Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich speaking today on the House floor. In his latest commentary, religious studies professor Ira Chernus advocates a new viewpoint toward the war on Gaza. The University of Colorado professor says people should adopt a position that is pro-peace, pro-Palestine, and pro-Israel in order to help the civilians in Gaza. Ira Chernus, glad to have you with us. In Gaza today, the Palestinian people are under attack for the 12th day. Whether someone is pro-Israel or not, many agree that there is no safe place even for the children in Gaza. How is it possible not to take sides here?
I think we can take sides in the sense that we can say that Israel was wrong to attack Gaza. Israel was wrong to economically isolate Gaza and inflict such suffering on the people weeks and months before this attack. Israel's policy to Gaza has been wrong all along. My point is that if we want to do something practical to help the people of Gaza, we have to bring pressure on the U.S. government. And in order to pressure our elected officials, officials in the Obama administration, to change U.S. policy, to be more even-handed, we really have to call for an even-handed policy that shows concern for the long-term well-being of both sides. If we simply criticize Israel and ask our government to take what looks like an anti-Israel side, they won't do it. So from a very practical point of view, to help the people of Gaza, I think we have to call for an even-handed approach.
And what is that approach? In your latest op-ed, you advocate a two-state solution. But if that is the only reasonable answer, if there is a right answer, why hasn't more been done by both sides already to move toward that two-state solution?
Well, it's certainly true that on both sides, there have been intransigent forces that have been preventing that two-state solution. But there are people, well-placed people on both sides of goodwill who for years and years have known the eventual necessary shape of a genuine peace agreement. We saw this in the Geneva Accord. We saw this in the Palestinian prisoners document. So everybody knows what the long-term settlement has to look like. There's no secret about that. Again, the big challenge for us here in the U.S. is to put enough pressure on our government to really work for that fair settlement. And that's why I say that a call for an even-handed pro-Palestine, pro-Israel, pro-peace position is the only one that will move our government in the right direction.
You've written extensively on nonviolence. But as a practical matter, is it possible for somebody to hold an effective resistance nonviolently when they're being bombed?
Well, yes. I mean, it can be done. It can be done. And I would certainly call on my fellow Jews in Israel to respond to whatever violence is inflicted on them with nonviolent resistance, particularly since the Israelis clearly have such a huge preponderance of power. Right, there are all sorts of nonviolent techniques that they can use, and the very first one is to practice justice, is to withdraw their occupation forces, to treat their Palestinian neighbors in a just and ultimately in a loving way. And yes, that can be done. It's enormously difficult when there's been so much bad blood between the two sides. But there's nothing that prevents people who have been opposed to each other from recognizing that either they all rise or they all fall together, and from embarking on a more peaceful course. We've seen it done many times in history in other places in the world. Eventually, it's got to happen in the Middle East, and I say, why not start now?
Ira Chernus, professor at University of Colorado in the Religious Studies Department at Boulder. His latest commentary on the crisis in Gaza is available at commondreams.org. Thanks for talking with us, Ira Chernus. And now we'll go to Buenos Aires, where attractions like tango, quaint cafes, and soccer matches bring millions of tourists to the South American city each year. But the boom in tourism and real estate values in Argentina's capital and largest city has also brought a housing crisis in which thousands have been evicted. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports.
In San Telmo, one of the oldest neighborhoods in Buenos Aires, residents are seeing a lot of changes. Recently, youth hostels, high-rises, and newly renovated lofts for short-term rentals have been popping up left and right. This charming neighborhood has traditionally been an eclectic mix of artists, working-class residents, and tourists. But as this balance between rich and poor has shifted, many poor residents are being pushed out. Hernán Membrillo is a Buenos Aires City government employee.
So far this year, there's been 375 evictions in Buenos Aires. A total of 3,323 families have been evicted, which would amount to approximately 8,000 people.
8,000 personas aproximadamente.
Police have evicted nearly 8,000 people, according to official statistics. These are people who are renting without a formal lease, generally renting rooms in boarding houses or hotels. The owners decide to kick them out. For many real estate owners, it is more profitable to sell or turn the property into a hostel than to rent to low-income tenants. Even though residents are paying high rent, the courts and police guard the interests of the property owners. And the city government's only cosmetic action is limited to providing an emergency subsidy to those soon to be homeless. Inside residency hotels, entire families often live in a single room, sharing communal bathrooms with other tenants. Owners charge more than $300 a month for a single room. Corina Suarez was paying nearly $250 a month for a room. That was until she and her daughters received an eviction notice.
They want to evict us. 6 months ago, the swindling owner began threatening us. Today, we got the eviction notice. We were cheated. They swindled us. When we moved here, we paid rent. Then, all of a sudden, we get an eviction order.
Tenants who have not signed a formal lease have no protections against being evicted, even if they pay their rent on time. Pablo Diaz, director of the city's emergency housing program, says that the city provides a $1,500 subsidy for families who are about to become homeless.
The program has two plans of action. One is providing housing and homeless shelters for single people and for families in evacuation centers. The other is providing a subsidy for families as part of the homeless family program.
Without zoning laws and rent protection, tenants have no assistance other than a one-time emergency housing subsidy. Many residents are fighting back. Days before a scheduled eviction, entire families poured into the streets to protest the eviction notice. Children in white school smocks held signs, "A Christmas without evictions, we don't want to become homeless." Again, Corina Suarez.
Today we came out into the street because we got an eviction notice for 50 families. That's 150 children who are going to be thrown into the street. The mayor offers us a $150 subsidy, but $150 is worthless. What we want is a loan to obtain proper housing, or that they provide us with housing so we can live in decent conditions.
Local organizations like the Asamblea de San Telmo, a popular neighborhood assembly, are working against gentrification and homelessness. Earlier this year, 23 people were arrested for resisting a forced eviction. Ana Mernick is a neighborhood organizer with the Asamblea de San Telmo fighting for housing rights.
Our commitment is to fight against evictions even more. There has to be a law that prohibits evictions and prohibits unfair rent hikes.
Buenos Aires government offices report more evictions are planned for 2009. In San Telmo, as low-income housing disappears, more chain restaurants and boutiques continue to grow, while local businesses also get pushed out. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Today, the Congressional Budget Office projected a $1.2 trillion deficit for 2009, the biggest deficit on record since World War II. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Weak financial markets, the billions spent on the bailout, the foreclosure crisis, and increases in funding for programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security have all been calculated up. The total, a projected $1.2 trillion. John Irons is a research and policy director with the Economic Policy Institute. He says the deficit numbers caught many off guard.
I think we're learning that the economic downturn is much more severe than people feared even 6 months ago.
And things may be getting even worse. The Congressional Budget Office predicts lower tax revenue because of increasing unemployment and higher government spending. For the CBO's calculations, economists included new factors, including money used for the Troubled Asset Relief Program and the government takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Ann Vorst, fiscal policy director for the New America Foundation, says there had been a debate on whether these items would actually be included in the deficit numbers because entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are considered technically off-budget items. But Vorst says with all the government spending, openness should be the priority.
It's only right for transparency reasons, to be realistic and so on, that the costs to the taxpayer in the short run of the assumption of Fannie and Freddie be reflected in these normal numbers.
But what will a $1.2 trillion deficit mean for average Americans? John Irons from the Economic Policy Institute says at this point, Americans are keeping their heads down, and even though the numbers may be scary, the economy will eventually turn around.
Most people are worried about their own economic conditions. They're worried about their incomes. They're worried about whether or not they'll have a job at this time next year. This is a case where the federal government will need to get their house in order eventually, but in the meantime, it's important for the federal government to really try to lend a helping hand to the private economy.
That helping hand could come in the form of President-elect Obama's economic stimulus package, but the CBO says even with an economic plan, the deficit is still on target to grow. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
As Karen Miller reported that the CBO projects a deficit greater than $1 trillion, President-elect Barack Obama said that that deficit could grow in the short term, but to control long-term deficit, Obama has announced a new position that will comb through the budget to rid it of waste. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
At his first formal press conference in Washington as president-elect, Obama offered solemn news about the state of the economy and the resulting federal budget.
My own economic and budget team projects that unless we take decisive action, even after our economy pulls out of its slide, trillion-dollar deficits will be a reality for years to come.
Obama's decisive action is to create a new position in his administration called the Chief Performance Officer. Nancy Killefer, a former Clinton Treasury Department executive, will be part of the Office of Management and Budget. Her job is to analyze the budget and determine the inefficiencies.
In order to restore confidence in our economy, we must restore the American people's confidence in their government, that it's on their side, spending their money wisely to meet their families' needs.
Obama says the new position is necessary now more than ever with a looming $1.2 trillion deficit and an economic recovery package of investments and tax cuts that would add to it. The president-elect also says entitlement programs such as Medicare and Social Security could be altered, especially in light of the dire budget news. David Rosnick is an economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says entitlement programs cost more each year, but controlling the root cause would rein in costs.
The difficulty with entitlements lies in the long term, and it is driven almost entirely by a broken overall healthcare system, not by Social Security or Medicare itself. And so that's something that has to be dealt with in the long term, is revamping our healthcare system rather than dealing specifically with entitlements.
Obama says the budget he will send Congress will reflect his priorities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Despite dire news about the economy, a positive development in the green revolution is taking place across the country. Many cities and states have begun contracting with local farmers to grow produce for food banks. FSRN's Martha Baskin has this report on Washington State's Farm to Food Bank project.
15,000 pounds of locally grown organic beets have found a new market this winter. Washington State Food Banks, The pilot project, Farms to Food Banks, passed by the state legislature, allocates $350,000 to food relief agencies to contract directly with state farmers for year-round produce. If this doesn't sound like news to you, take a visit to a food bank and you'll see the need. Paul Haas, with the Hunger Action Center of Seattle-based Solid Ground, smiles as he waves an invoice for 15,000 pounds of beets.
I'm ready to frame it because we worked over the last year or two on this project called Farms to Food Banks. And it's going to be feeding, you know, people who otherwise are not going to get a lot of access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
At a time when nearly 1 in 8 Americans is food insecure or hungry, according to the USDA's annual report, the organic red beets stand out in a food system dominated by subsidized food giants.
We actually have probably a wall of beets behind you, and they've been really well received. I think the quantity was more than we had anticipated, which was great.
Joe Gruber with Seattle's largest North End food bank, the U District Food Bank, has long-standing relationships with farmers who donate produce at the end of a farmer's market. But these beets are about cultivating business relationships with farmers who are paid to grow produce for those in need. What's more, the produce is nutritious and comes with a low carbon and packaging footprint.
When we look at where the food bank gets backlogged, where the traffic jams are, it's at the produce section. And I think it's a lot of times because folks are really looking for the produce that they want.
Today's local produce include pears and apples, yams and red potatoes, turnips, Swiss chard, kale, and packaged spinach from California. Equalizing and expanding access to quality local food is on the minds of many, from those working to change the federal farm bill's emphasis on subsidizing food giants to building capacity for small and mid-sized local farms to food justice activists like Mark Winnie. Winnie is author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty.
Most food banks that I know of are committed to making the healthiest food available that they can to their clients. Yet, they're forced to take whatever the food industry donates to them, or in some cases, what the U.S. Department of Agriculture donates to them. And that's not always the healthiest food.
Winnie supports the efforts of states and cities to provide locally grown food for food banks, but says the real need is to end poverty with a new economic stimulus package that recognizes the millions of Americans who are slipping from working poverty to humbling desperation. Take the case of a mother and daughter who turned to Seattle's Family Works Food Bank for the first time.
Single mom, working really hard. I'm trying to keep up with my bills, and I can't buy food. I have to choose between having gas so I can make it to work and buying food.
This mom, who asked to be identified as a member of the community, is a social worker. She wasn't sure what she'd find at the food bank.
I really wanted to make chicken soup because the girls are coming down with something, but I don't think I'll find chicken, but, you know, whatever I can find.
A food bank in another neighborhood had frozen chickens. The one she visited only had chicken broth. Winnie suggests a new national food program, one he dubbed the Food for All program. The program would work in tandem with an effective campaign to end poverty and would incorporate health insurance, quality education, child care, and a living wage for all. Until then, food banks in Washington and others around the nation will continue to partner with local farmers to share the bounty.
And we still have fresh produce coming up, even in January and February.
Chris Curtis with Seattle's Neighborhood Farmers Market Alliance.
We're going to see potatoes, we're going to see broccoli and cauliflowers, and so some of the actually the most nutritionally dense vegetables come out of the ground in the winter, and yeah, they're still going to be available there for food banks.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin.
And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Rose Kitabji, sitting in for Aura Bogado.